So good morning. Welcome to the second of the two sessions that we have on gender and thinking, working politically. So a few of you were at the session yesterday afternoon, which was fantastic. Thank you to the presenters again. The research agenda for the gender and thinking and working politically is actually trying to bring together the two strands of gender and governance, gender and power dynamics, gender and politics. Because often with that, I'm speaking as a governance person, governance overlooks gender. It's a bit gender blind. And you know, when we're doing political economy analysis, the gender dimensions of power, which is the most fundamental power relationship that is often overlooked. So what we're trying to do as well is really a sort of explore the collective action and the coalition building and the exercise of power, really relating back to different types of power. I think as Duncan Green at Portsett and also Sally Moyle, who was our former gender specialist, there's so many different dimensions of power that needs to be explored within this field. There's the power over, there's the power to, there's the power with, all differently expressed. So I'm going to shut up very, very, very soon. I'd just like to say a big thank you to Associate Professor Chris Roche from La Trobe University for pulling the two panels together. And I think that needs to be acknowledged. He's done a great job in actually coordinating all of this and writing it all up. Thank you. So today's session, we're going to have three presentations and five speakers, mainly talking about women's collective action and power and politics. And, of course, my favourite subject, coalitions. Excellent. So I think we'll just go into... So the really interesting stuff about this is it really explores what Michael Wilcox was talking about yesterday with the problem-driven, adaptive, iterative, problem-solving kind of approach that collective action can actually, you know, try to resolve. And it's non-linear. It's actually, it goes all over the shop because that's the way life actually is. So I'd like to actually introduce you to... Oh, but before I do that, I'm really happy I have notes because I thought I would forget this. The common threads of most of this program is going to be brought together under a research program by the Developmental Leadership Program. They're going to be putting out an interactive PDF about in the next 12 months, so watch out for that. It'll be super exciting and hopefully very, very useful for practitioners in the field. Okay, so first of all, I'd like to introduce Tanya McQueen. Tanya McQueen is from Gardner. She's a gender specialist, and she was the designer of the Mumpu project. And then we will have Hannah Derwent from DFAT, who is going to be talking about how it actually worked, because she managed it when she was the first secretary there. So we're going to be talking about working on empowering women's agency leadership and working with coalitions. Thank you very much.
Today is really about DFAT's experience designing and implementing a women's leadership and coalitions program. So I'll draw on my experience as a former DFAT officer who's running the program, and having drawn her experience as the kind of DFAT officer who oversaw that implementation phase. At this point, I just want to acknowledge Scott Guggenheim's contribution. He was the former social development advisor to DFAT. So in 2011, I was charged with the responsibility of designing a gender project or gender programming in Indonesia for DFAT. I really had no scope, no parameters. It was really a blank slate. What we did have was a very big interest in creating a program that could seek to foster large-scale transformational change that would really make a difference in the lives of poor women in Indonesia. So as we looked around the world and in Indonesia, and as we looked around to see what really were the common drivers of transformational change, what we saw was, commonly, the presence of individuals, groups, organisations, often ragtag bunches, that had come together over a particular issue, common interest, even enemy, essentially a coalition to drive change. Where there was a gender dimension, these coalitions were often led by women. And we look in Indonesia, you know, women's organisations working collectively with also with other stakeholders managed to pressure the government into adopting CEDAW, adopting legislation that criminalises rape in marriage. They were also a catalyst, a huge catalyst for the establishment of the Commission on Violence, Commission on Violence Against Women, who are very active in protecting women's rights in Indonesia. So based on this, we added coalitions and women's leadership to be the driving force of the program. So inserting a donor in a collective action process is quite risky. And so we knew from the outset it was really important that we had the program partners co-design the program if we had any chance of this being an effective program. So we developed a selection criteria, really, to help us focus in and find suitable partners that could do that with us. This really looked like our broad selection criteria. We really wanted to see organisations, partner with organisations that had a huge geographical reach, were experienced in driving change through collective action, and were committed to working with their own vertical structures through their membership bases or their networks, but also a commitment to working with external parties to those structures, government, academia, whoever they deemed important for that change process to occur. So kind of with that in mind, we identified 8 partners who we thought kind of had these characteristics. I mean, look at Aisha. Aisha is a mass-based Islamic organisation with 15 million members. I mean, their geographic reach and scope, absolutely incredible. Having access to so many people, amazing. And PETA, you know, 25,000 members. Most of those are female-headed households scattered across the country. So these organisations are incredible, with incredible reach and a demonstrated history of driving change. So we approached those partners, and over about 6 months, they helped us design the program. Helped us design the program goal, outcomes, theory of change. I mean, pretty important that your partners help you design the theory of change, especially around collective action, especially around the time frames. I mean, they need to really, influence that based on their experience, and they did. Hopefully it still stands. they also helped us design the program management and governance arrangements, and they came up with the name as well. So we'll just move on to some key design features just really quickly. There's a lot to mention, but just quickly, to narrow the scope of the program and to give peer reviewers some idea of what we were going to do, we came up with 5 themes with the partners that would broadly guide the work of the program at a very high level. So those themes were access to government social protection programs, improving conditions for women's overseas labour migration, reducing violence against women. So remember these themes that we thought would make, if we could achieve change, would make a difference in the lives of poor women. The other thing that was important to this process was pilot and move to scale. As I said, we wanted to see large-scale kind of programs come out of this, or large-scale change. So we couldn't be supporting small programs in the district. We needed it to have national reach. So the partners were asked to design a little pilot based on what they were already doing, based on what they thought could be scaled, was yielding some change, at least at the local level, and then they move towards implementation. Just lastly, the managing contractor, what body supports a collective action kind of program? You know, we asked the organisations and they said, we want a managing contractor as opposed to another organisation, another NGO, another women's group, because I felt there was a level of impartiality there, and that managing contractor wouldn't favour one over the other. So that's the reason for the managing contractor. So now Mark, who's 5 years old, and Hannah's going to deliver the achievements.
Thanks, Tanya.
Good morning, everyone. My name's Hannah Derwin. I'm from 2012 to 2015, which pretty much I oversaw the implementation of MUMPL. That pretty much covered the first four-year phase. I have a number of slides that I've now cut, I just quickly wanted to touch on the fact that the program was really principles-based, so rather than being activity or log-frame-based, the design as it is very principles-based, and these are some of the key principles that the program has been guided by. So I wanted to go straight to the achievements. So Tanya mentioned the 8 partners before that that we initially involved in the design process. Now in 2017, the program has 20 direct recipient partners and 115 sub-partners. We've created more than 2,000 new women's groups, and the program has a presence in 26 of Indonesia's 34 provinces and about 175, well, I think it's roughly 500 districts. The program can count 52,000 direct beneficiaries, but we're now looking at around 800,000 indirect beneficiaries from policy changes to date, and there are plenty more policy changes to come, so that's an early figure. So what are those policy changes? There are many across the program, but I wanted to highlight 3 today, which I think really bring together the whole element of coalition and why it's been so successful. So the first one is looking at the issue of migration. One of the 5 thematic areas, as Tanya mentioned before, is improving conditions for women migrant workers overseas. On this theme, we worked with, from the very beginning, with Migrant Care, which is a fairly large, high-profile, national-based organisation. And from the very beginning, Migrant Care was super clear on what they wanted to do. So classically, a migrant worker will go overseas and will receive very little information about what they're getting involved in until they're about to depart from the city that they depart from. So what Migrant Care realised was that information needed to come to the village level, and the local government needed to be involved in regulating that information and regulating the recruitment of migrant workers as well, and also helping with documentation and helping with the safety of the migrant workers when they're overseas and making sure that they can still connect to their families back home. So they created a program called Des Bumi, or Desa Peduli Migran, which means villages that care for migrants. So Migrant Care had this excellent national level advocacy skills, connections and an unrivaled media profile, but they hadn't really worked in grassroots community organising. So through MUMPL, we were able to set up a relationship with local organisations that they already had a relationship with, but we were able to set up a funding relationship so that Migrant Care could do its work at the national level and the local organisations could set up Des Bumi in the villages. 2014, the new Minister for Manpower, Pahani Takiri, is inaugurated. He's reform-minded, there's a lot of pressure on him to do something about the migrant worker situation. And from the very beginning of his inauguration, Migrant Care is exposing him to Des Bumi, taking him to villages and showing him what is happening and how they are working to improve the situation. The monitoring and evaluation system from the program can track his comments along the way. So at the beginning of his term, he was saying things like, this is a program that my team needs to study, to more recently saying, this is something we want to replicate. I think towards the end of last year, the Ministry of Manpower is now launching Des Migratif, which is their own program, which is also looking at, which is heavily influenced by Des Bumi, and will work complementarily with Des Bumi, which he's made a lot of comments about. And the program will be trialled in 100 villages in 2017 with a wider view to replication further in migrant-sending villages. So these are particular geographical locations. Migrants don't come from all over Indonesia. The features of Des Migratif, the Ministry of Manpower program, that draw from Des Bumi are the village government's central role in regulating migrant worker recruitment, providing information to prospective migrants, and supporting their families. And all at the same time, Migrant Care is lobbying at the national level to improve the laws and the systems, the national level systems around protecting migrant workers. My second example is on reproductive health. So Aisha, as Tanya mentioned before, is one of 2 mass-based Islamic organisations in Indonesia, large ones, sorry. And it, from the beginning, has been working on reproductive health. A particular focus was the screening and testing and diagnosis and treatment of cervical cancer, being a government of Indonesia priority and being something that the new universal health coverage scheme is supposed to cover, but something that health professionals don't... There aren't many health professionals that can administer the testing and the screening and the treatment. So Aisha's model is to go into a district, work with the local women, organise them, get them understanding more about their reproductive health and their rights and, you know, what access, what services are available, and at the same time working with the local departments of health to upskill them, to administer the tests, to be able to do all the treatment and screening. And at the same time, they're also working with the Bupati, or the district head, and the Kapala Dinkes, or the head of the local department of health, to show them the model, to get them to understand that this is possible, that this is what they can roll out. This approach is beginning to bear fruit, and recently in the district of Demak in central Java, Aisha convinced the Bupati and the head of the health authority to allocate budget to replicate the model in all puskesmas, or community health centres they're called, in the district. But the path has not been straightforward. So Aisha's been working on this for quite a long time. And the critical juncture where they got support from the district head was when they started to lobby local parlamentarians as well. Local parliamentarians to remind the government that this is actually a government of Indonesia priority, that it's covered by the national health system, but that people can't access it because of the skill is not there. So that was a really important juncture. And interestingly, Mampu also hosted a massive parliamentarian forum in, I think it was 2014, and Aisha invited those parliamentarians to that event. So the coalition was sort of building for many years. The final case study I want to talk about is one of our women's rights and women's leadership. And this is working with a partner called Kapal Perempuan. And they, for decades, have had a model of what they call Sekolah Perempuan, a women's school, which is a village-level sort of forum where women come together, engage in intensive rights awareness training and a range of other learning, including literacy for those who are literate. And it's a really important forum for developing and creating and fostering local women leaders. Under Mampu, Sekolah Perempuan connected to a district-level committee. And this committee consisted of a lot of important stakeholders and decision-makers and local government. And the idea was that what gets discussed at the village level goes up to the district level. The model's really promising in terms of creating women leaders and changing thinking on women's rights. The program's been active in a number of areas, but one of them is South Sulawesi, in a district called Pangkep. And the head of Pangkep has long been connected to the sub-partner who's working in the area. And within a couple of weeks of being re-elected in his most recent term, he agreed to replicate the Sekolah Perempuan model in other villages in Pangkep, with over ₱1 billion allocated to that effort. There's also some promising commitment from the governments of Gresik in East Java and North Lombok. So what can we see are the common threads for ingredients for success here? Well, it comes as no surprise. Forming key alliances and long-term relationships and keeping those relationships and fostering them for those critical moments when, you know, our policymakers can make change. Showing a tangible model for policymakers. So especially on the migration and reproductive health examples, the policymakers had something they could actually see in front of their eyes. The partners weren't just advocating on issues, they were advocating on proposed solutions. And finally, providing a solution to a current policy pressure for decision makers. So what are the policy makers under pressure to do something on now? And I think the migration and reproductive health examples are very pertinent in terms of that. A couple of challenges of the program. Accessing local government is a challenge. So I've given you examples where local government has been quite receptive, but they're also, you know, Indonesia has 17,000 islands, so it's a varied map. So some partners are reporting difficulty in accessing local government. That could also be related to the huge subnational election process which carried out yesterday. But if there are other issues, the contractor is looking into that to see if, you know, what else is going on. And what is the continuing role of partners as replication takes place? So governments are replicating Mampu efforts and Mampu partner, not Mampu, Mampu partner efforts and programs. And so what do partners do now that that's happening? So for Aisha, for example, the local government is replicating the health side of things because they run the departments of health. But a really important component of that program is also organising the women at the grassroots level and increasing their awareness around reproductive health. So what is Aisha's role going forward? Is sort of half the program is taken up, but the other half is still up to the mass-based organisation. That's it. Thanks a lot.
Great, I'm just going to talk. Thank you very much, Tanya and Hannah. the Mampu program is a fascinating one, actually. Just to sort of really tell, they built these trusted relationships, and from building those trusted relationships, they can actually access the spaces to sort of, you know, work on future changes that will actually impact on government policy, and then it will be, like, the ripple effect is enormous. Okay, then I'm just going to chat while the next speakers are going to get ready to do their presentation. So, pardon me. The second presentation is by Penny Tawaki from the Pacific Leadership Program and Rebecca McLaren from La Trobe University. And this is the findings of a paper that BLP commissioned last year. Was it last year? Yeah. Dr. Lisa Denny, who's in the audience, I have to do a shout out to you, who was the main author of the paper, and Rebecca McLaren was also one of the authors. So this was essentially commissioned because it's one of those flexible, adaptive, iterative programs. It's really quite hard to do any monitoring evaluation, and it's also quite hard to explain what they actually do. There's some magic in here somewhere. How do you actually understand how it operates? So this is why this paper was commissioned. And it sort of highlights the way they support coalitions to progress gender equality. And sort of this, what they're going to be talking about is what it's learned about the nature of coalitions. Also, if you want to access the paper, the larger paper, it's been posted as a blog on the DevPulse site late last year, and it's also available through the Developmental Leadership Program website. So, okay, we will then... So I think you're speaking first. Tanya's going to be speaking first, and then Penny's going to be speaking first. Oh, sorry.
Tanya isn't
us. Oh, sorry. Pardon me, sorry.
I didn't know you.
Okay, I'm just going to hand over before I say anything else.
I think it's just a big file. There's lots of pretty pictures in there. So. Oh, no, it's a lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Slows down.
So I'm just going to chat. This is where we actually need technological best practice, but sometimes it's just not possible. I can shut up now.
Wonderful. All right. Thanks very much for the intro, Sandra. Yeah, so today Penny and I will talk about the Pacific Leadership Program, otherwise known as PLP, and its experience of thinking and working politically to support, in particular, gender coalitions. So the Pacific Leadership Program is funded by the Australian Aid Program, and it supports leaders across the Pacific, as well as in four target countries: Samoa, Solomon Islands, Tonga and Vanuatu. And it's $52 million since 2008, and the current phase is due to end this year. So our research looked at actually four action research case studies of coalitions supported by PLP and what their experience tells us about thinking and working politically. So these are the ones that we looked at up here, but today we're actually going to focus in on two of those coalitions which supported work to pursue gender issues. The first one is Women in Shared Decision Making, Wisdom, in Vanuatu, and Simbo for Change in the Solomon Islands. So the Wisdom Coalition was formed to push for greater women's political participation in Vanuatu. PLP provided almost $300,000 to this process. Initially, Wisdom consisted mostly of CSOs, and the Director of Women's Affairs in Vanuatu was also involved. However, over time, it came to be that it was led by the Director of Women's Affairs, who drew on her personal and professional networks as needed to push for the reform. So what were the outcomes of this process? It basically led to the passage of new legislation temporarily reserving 30 to 34% of municipal seats for women. And this led to five women being elected at the provincial level in the following elections in January 2014. So what was PLP's role in this process? Well, firstly, they held a symposium for Wisdom members to learn and exchange ideas on how to act as developmental leaders and leverage their own networks. Secondly, they provided flexible funding that allowed the director to do things like organise a retreat for stakeholders that needed to be lobbied to support the reform. And finally, they acted as a critical friend, constructively challenging the director's ideas, making suggestions and acting as sounding boards. So the second coalition we're looking at today is Simbo for Change. And this was a partnership between a local woman leader, the Samoa Women in Business Development Incorporated, otherwise known as SWIBD, and PLP. So Simbo is a small island in the Solomon Islands, quite remote, and the purpose of this initiative was to develop niche agricultural exports as a means of empowering women and their families. The idea was to reduce women's travel. They needed to go to the nearby market, which was quite far away. They had to go by boat, and it meant spending several days at a time away from home, and whilst there, they were often exposed to threats of intimidation, exploitation and violence. There were also concerns around child protection because while women were away, their children were left at home with their fathers, and this did expose some of them to risk, particularly girls who are at risk of sexual violence. So although not an explicit goal of this initiative, it became something that was pursued in the sidelines. So, yeah, and PLP has provided around $200,000 for this initiative. So in terms of outcomes, it hasn't all been plain sailing. There's been a lot of iterative and adaptive learning going on. The main thing that they're pursuing is organic certification for the island, which will be the first island in Solomon Islands to achieve this. And that process has already commenced and is well on its way. They've also been experimenting with new crops. Firstly, experimenting with virgin coconut oil, but found that the benefits of that work was not being spread far enough within the community, and so they've expanded to working on beehives, which is they found to be more inclusive of benefits in the community. It's also led to a lot of reinvigoration within communities, some of which were sort of lagging and cooperation was lagging, so there's now renewed cooperation between men, women and community leaders. In terms of PLP's role, they've really let the local partners identify what the issue. So it's really, in a way, PDIA. They've let partners identify what the issue is and identify ways forward. And they've also provided the space for them to take approaches that are appropriate to that context and culture. For example, SWIBD male staff have been able to take appropriate approaches to opening up sensitive discussions with the community about child protection, which is something outsiders simply could not have done. And SWIBD staff were able to do this partially because of their chiefly status and historical ties between the Solomon Islands and Samoa. PLP, though, although taking a back seat and letting the partners lead, still has played a critical friend role in influencing in the sidelines to further the effectiveness of this program. So what do these two coalitions tell us about supporting gender coalitions? Well, firstly, it shows that you can think and work politically to make progress on issues not high on the political agenda. Thinking and working politically typically emphasises working with the grain, which can mean aligning with the interests of elites who tend to be men. And this can mean that issues around gender are often neglected. But in the case of Wisdom, you can see that they've managed to do this by, firstly, the director has chosen to frame the issue of women's political participation not as a gender or women's issue, but as simply a technical part of broader electoral reform, which has made it much less controversial and more procedural and therefore more likely to be accepted. Also, the Director of Women's Affairs has focused on where change is possible. So initially she did focus at the national level to try to promote women's political representation at that level. There was found to be a resistance there, and so they refocused their efforts at the municipal level, where there is less resistance and there's sort of more of an understanding of women need to start at lower levels to prove themselves to before taking on higher office. And that has meant the process has been successful. Secondly, we can see that leaders can draw their power and legitimacy from both formal and informal spheres. So you see with the Director of Women's Affairs in Vanuatu with Wisdom, she had formal power but also drew extensively on her other sources of legitimacy, her customary role and kinship networks. In Simbo, however, the women's leader had more informal power, being from a chiefly family, but also through the reputation she has built up locally through her community, business and church work. This is important because often we may focus on formal power, which tends to privilege men, and that can lead to the informal power that women hold being ignored. So if we want to support women's leadership, we need to think outside of the box of where we look for that. So thirdly, we found that there's a need to be pragmatic when supporting coalitions and leaders. It's more important to engage with leaders and coalitions that have the interest, power and ability to drive change, rather than those who necessarily adhere to good governance principles. So, for example, with Wisdom, has found that you don't need to be inclusive to be effective. This process was quite exclusive and yet successful in driving these reforms. The Director of Women's Affairs chose not to actively engage with women CSOs, which would have highlighted the issue as a women's rights issue and therefore made it more controversial. Rather, she lobbied individuals across government, mostly men, recognising that it was ultimately male parliamentarians who would be voting on the reform. This really raises questions, I guess, about the generally received wisdom on how to achieve change in relation to gender, which often does promote sort of inclusive processes. However, having said that, it does depend on the part of the policy cycle that you're intending to influence. So while Wisdom's exclusive process may have been successful in getting a more speedy passage of this legislation, it's questionable whether this exclusive process would work in the long term in terms of trying to achieve the attitudinal changes that you need to promote women's political participation. And the final finding we've had is that coalitions are not necessarily fixed or formal, but fluid and evolving. So it means that coalitions may not necessarily look like what donors may expect. And really, again, it's similar to what Michael was talking about yesterday. It's really about function over form. In terms of this fluidity, it's particularly important in the Pacific, where small populations mean that networks are particularly dense and overlapping. And you can see, particularly with the Wisdom Coalition, that membership has really morphed and changed over time to meet the needs of the reform. And I'll pass over to Penny, who will talk to you about how PLP staff think in working politically to make these changes.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks, Vic. So I'll just be talking briefly through four points about how the program thinks and works politically. The first is about knowing the local context and being politically aware. I guess for us, really, as Pacific Island staff of a DFAT program, what's been really important is that the program's recruited Pacific Islanders across the program, except for our team leader, who's also the managing contractor representative. So you're really drawing on people who have broad development experience, come from a variety of backgrounds, have networks across the communities, churches, schools, and are invaluable in identifying development entrepreneurs and instances of current or emerging collective action. One thing we've been speaking about over the last few days, or the last day or so, with some of the people who've met here has been how if you're working in programmatically, you really need to have a certain, intuition or X factor. I think there's a, it's not magic, like Sandra said, but an ability to, think and work politically, to cross-pollinate ideas when you're supporting coalitions, knowing when to push a little or to pull back a little. And also, I think something that's quite significant for the Pacific is recognizing the different silences that people have. And sometimes that can be quite palpable. So you'll sense when you're speaking, when people vehemently disagree with you, but no one said anything. I think that's also quite a skill that we try to nurture in our staff. Something that's quite workaday is what we call the division of labor between a good cop and a bad cop. We have headquarters staff and staff who work in country. I remember when I first started the program, I worked with Sina Retzlaff, who some of you may know. And when we first had our partner meeting, she goes, okay, well, we go in, I'll be the bad cop and you can be the good cop. I said, you know, we can work whichever way you like. So we walked in and she goes, oh, so what if we decided to cut the budget on? And that was quite challenging, but then it makes you realize that seen as living in and from the context and has to work with these people on a daily basis, whereas we fly in and fly out essentially, there's remote support, and that gives us the space to be able to still work with these people. Beck spoke of this earlier about having a shared history, culture, and faiths across the Pacific, and that really helps us get our foot in the door. For example, with the work in Simbo with Wibdi. Samoan missionaries have been going to Solomons for over a century, so their coming back to support the project really meant that there was already an affinity between the people, and that allowed them to have these difficult conversations about child protection. More broadly as a program, Rebecca spoke about being a critical friend, and I think it's really the understanding that our investment, the funding, the human resources, the networking, etc., that we provide to the partners really gives us access, credibility, and space within these partnerships. The programs also use the partnership building model from the Partnership Brokers Association, and we've found it really beneficial to the way we're working now with coalitions. Having a solid foundation where you're building on having a mutual benefit, accountability, and trust really gives you the space over time to be able to challenge partners about the work they're doing, try to give them strategic directions, and really provide a listening ear for the work that they're doing. So in terms of using local knowledge to identify who to work with and how, I guess, again, just to reiterate how we exploit's not a great word, but really that's what you do in the program, exploiting the staff extensive network. So recognizing the staff come with networks across families, churches, schools, unis. I mean, anyone who's worked in the Pacific knows that quite often people ask you which high school you went to rather than which university, and that's really where the networks start from. In terms of headhunting leaders and coalitions, in the photograph you see, you might recognize the Deputy Prime Minister of Samoa, Fiamme Mataafa, talking with Sina there. This is at a meeting of the Women in Leadership Advocacy Association, a loose network of women in leadership in the private sector and public sector in Samoa. We've been talking to Fiamme about this, working with this group since 2012, and we've only just started working with them this week. Actually, there's a couple of workshops running with them around reform issues that they've identified. But I guess it goes to show how critical it is to have a solid, robust relationship before you enter into actual programmatic partnerships. Fiamme has always been quite adamant that we should work with her, but for the program, it's really been about selecting the time and issue that we can support her to work on. Okay, we've spoken on the last point, so I guess we'll move on. In terms of working informally and informally behind the scenes, I'd like to pick up the point that was raised in the room yesterday where someone spoke about safe spaces. Those of you who work in the Pacific will know that the talanoa, or discussion, is a really important part of the way the Pacific works. And the programs really use this to foster relationships, discussions, and also give partners an opportunity to really continue to initiate discussions informally. There's obviously kava involved quite often, and this speaks to the point I think Chris and a couple of other people spoke about. Donors' hesitation to support meetings and food. It's the Pacific, I guess. So it's a necessity to some degree. That's not to say it's been without its challenges. We've had to build really strong cases to DFAT about supporting meetings, whether it's food or informal talanoa sessions, but to really show that you're working towards an outcome of some sort. Sorry, I didn't get my notes. I'm having to read off my phone. I guess this really speaks to being prepared and, as well. Or learning to work with within the constraints. Beck spoke briefly about working behind the scenes and allowing partners to lead. So it's really been about letting partners have visibility in the projects that they're working on. There's usually an appearance of a light touch from the program, but again, this can be quite misleading. There's a lot of backroom negotiations that are happening around the work that's going on. I mean, for example, if we talk about the youth employment work that we supported with the Pacific Youth Council, we had to have a meeting with them in 2011 that really pushed member youth councils from across the region to try and identify a key issue that they wanted to work on. One of the challenges of supporting the Pacific Youth Council has been that they say, oh, we've got about 12 different things we'd like to work on, climate change, sexual and reproductive health. And for us as a donor-funded agency, it's quite hard to be able to justify supporting 12 different thematic areas with one organization. So we really had to try and work with them to identify one key issue, that was youth employment. And there's been progress on it since over the years, including resulting in being present on the Leaders Communique from the Forum Leaders Meeting in Auckland in 2011, as well as some national-level work that PYC continues to support over time. So it's really that the program's learned how valuable it is to understand how leaders are operating, and we've really built a tailored action research program to accompany informed partners and POP using an evaluative lens. This speaks to the point Sandra spoke about, you know, how difficult it is to show results or outcomes when you're supporting some reform issues. So action research, particularly the work we're doing with the SIMBO, with the Women's Economic Empowerment Program, has been really instrumental in drawing out some of the richer learnings about how communities are becoming more cohesive, women engaging more in decision-making, and also how the savings that they're making is really helping get children back into school. So one of the things that PLP does that's really helped refine and encourage more, I guess, courageous conversations, but also it's really influenced programming, has been having 6-monthly reflection meetings internally for staff. So it's really about inviting partners in country and other development practitioners to meet and discuss, quite frankly, work that the partners are working on, having quite, I wouldn't say brutal, but very robust conversations within the program about the directions the program is taking. I guess I'll just speak to this slide as well. Over time, we've had a real challenge in... In broadening the leadership engagement on the SIMBO for Change project. When we first started the work, it was really just working with Esther, the woman in the colourful dress on the side. So it's taken a number of years and interventions and discussions directly with her through WIBDI in Samoa and through other partners to really get her to understand that broadening the leadership engagement with the project to include other women would be beneficial not just to her but also the communities generally. To some degree, the programs had to almost force something, so we had to say, okay, you'll need to formalize your women's association because that will not only give you credibility, but it also helps you get funding from other donors or, you know, gives DFAT and our program an opportunity to see that you're actually making a difference in leading women as well. So, I mean, there's certain things that we've had to do with that as well. So I guess just to close, it's, and I hope I've spoken to this through the last few slides, there are three key lessons that, you know, for us, for donors, that for generally locally the development, the focus is on partnership and not on programs. And again, I think this is where you really need to have staff who are skilled in relationship building and managing to really manage those partnerships. There's not a lot of money that's involved per se, but you really do have to spend a lot of time with your staff, but also have a flexible spending model. Just briefly, when we started working with the Department of Women's Affairs in Vanuatu, we had about 48 hours to organize how to get funds across to Doris, the Director for Women's Affairs. And if we didn't have the possibility of working with an independent accounting firm that other DFAT programs use, we would have had to wait months to get funds through finance, then across to the ministry, and then, you know, acquitting that. We all know how difficult it can be to acquit funds or get funds from government departments. So it's really, that's been about flexible spending. And finally, the relationship of trust between donor and implementer is crucial. And in this regard, this is really speaking to what PLP was like in the last phase. We had co-location of what was in AusAid staff, so it really made decision-making quite easy. The staff were also, including Sandra, by the way, the staff were also very au fait with the program, so they knew exactly what was happening. All you required is a brief note regarding the next round of spending or different ways of using funds. Thank you.
you very much, Penny and Beth. That was an excellent presentation. So I'd like to now move on to the final presentation, and then we're going to open it up for questions. And today we have Tara Chetty, who is actually a gender advisor with the DFAT program, Pacific Women Shaping Pacific Development, and a support unit based in Suwon. So, and also Tara was the former head of the Fiji Women's Rights Movement. And the Fiji Women's Rights Movement is one of the preeminent women's organizations in the Pacific, very much advocating for human rights and gender equality, and it's a feminist-based organization, which I love saying about, you know, organizations. Fantastic. She's going to be talking about the necessity of also being inclusive in women's movements to promote sustainability. And she's going to be talking a little bit about We Rise as well. So I'd like to say welcome to Tara, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Sandra. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us so early in the morning. We didn't imagine we'd get so many people in the dawn shift, but it's lovely to see you. So I'll be talking today about the We Rise Coalition and really reflecting on many of the questions and ideas that were raised in yesterday's panel on thinking and working politically, and also by the earlier members, especially Penny and Rebecca. I'd also just like to acknowledge that we do have a member of the We Rise Coalition in the room. I thought I saw her earlier. Yes, there she is. Jo Hayter, the Executive Director of the International Women's Development Agencies, one of the members of the coalition that I'll be talking about. So I'm glad that Sandra outed my connection to the coalition, having headed one of the organisations formerly that is part of the coalition. The coalition itself is supported by the Pacific Women Shaping Pacific Development Program, which is Australia's big gender equality program in the Pacific region. It's an investment of $320 million over 10 years and is now 3 years into its implementation. The We Rise Coalition is actually supported by both the regional and the bilateral funding through the program, because it's a coalition that actually spans both Fiji and the region. So, who are they? That's me in my former role with my comrades at the time. The We Rise Coalition is made up of four organisations that work from an explicitly feminist frame. You've got DIVA for Equality, which is a lesbian, bisexual and trans persons collective in Fiji. FemLink Pacific, a women's community media organisation really focused on women, peace and security issues. The Fiji Women's Rights Movement, which is a women's rights organisation based in Fiji. And the International Women's Development Agency based in Melbourne, which works in the Asia Pacific. And all of the organisations also work regionally. So it's quite interesting to look at the We Rise Coalition, which is very deliberately and carefully gone about the process of building a coalition based on some key feminist principles that guide the work they do. So one of which is a principle around diversity and inclusivity, which does stand in quite stark contrast to the experience of the Wisdom Coalition. So it'll be quite interesting to think about them together. I also just wanted to make a note, and one of the reasons that I included this photograph, which is from the signing of the We Rise Coalition's MOU in Melbourne in April last year, is that it again highlights the point that Penny was making earlier about the value of locally engaged staff in development programming. So for Penny and myself and the many other locally engaged staff that work on development programs, it's not just about your role as defined within your job description, but it's really a lot more about the kind of rich contextual knowledge and relationships that we bring to the roles. Penny much more so than I. So how does the We Rise Coalition work? While in Pacific Women's experience, Pacific Women being the short form for the program in which I work, in Pacific Women's experience, we're working with this coalition now for 18 months. However, the We Rise Coalition and the organisations involved in the coalition have existing relationships that go over many years between multiple individuals within the organisations. So the relationships range from 10 years to 30 years between the organisations. And the relationships also extend. So while the We Rise Coalition are these four organisations we're looking at, the actual networks, formal and informal coalitions involved in the work and that all contribute towards the change that they're aiming for are actually multiple, varied and extensive. Like I mentioned earlier, it's been a very careful and deliberate process for this coalition in self-defining who they are, with a very high level of self-reflection. And a real example, I think, of what Michael Woolcock was talking about yesterday morning around this very tight, systematic, reflexive feedback loop. This is actually also a feminist methodology and one that they often use. The other interesting point about the We Rise Coalition and the way that it works is that despite its apparent formality of structure, and this was a really interesting conversation that Penny and I had earlier in reflecting on the two different experiences, where formality can often imply a sort of rigidness and an inability to move quickly with a changing context. In contrast, the We Rise's formality, or rather its process and the systems that they've set in place for their MOU, have enabled a high level of flexibility because it's helped to establish trust and very clear pathways for resolving problems. So that's meant they've been able to move very fast and have been able to adapt to changing circumstances quite quickly. So a key aspect of the way they work is feminist praxis, which they define as putting feminist theory and principle into action and the ongoing evolving practice through this regular feedback loop. Like Sharon reminds us, for those of us sitting on the donor end of development practice, a coalition is much more than just a project activity. And I think that's well described in the PLP approach to it. As they say, change doesn't happen within a project cycle. So while that's the way we can support them, there's much more going on beyond what is captured in a project activity. So there are five principles that are outlined in the Memorandum of Understanding, which is really not just a document on the shelf for the coalition, but what they describe as underlying their praxis. The commitment to equality, which has been really deliberately and carefully negotiated. The four organisations vary hugely in their form, in their budget, in their size, in their organisational practice. You've got DIVA for Equality, which started off at zero funding. It refused to accept formal funding until the We Rise Coalition, ranging to the International Women's Development Agency, working in the Asia-Pacific region with an annual budget of, I believe, about $7.5 million Australian dollars, roughly. Okay. And of course, FemLink and FWRM falling somewhere in between, with histories ranging from having DIVA starting in 2011 to other organisations like FWRM and IWDA, who are 30 years old. So an interesting example around equality in practice, I actually might leave that to the question time later because I know we have limited time, but I think solidarity is quite an interesting one because the coalition had some interesting conversations about how to deal with solidarity in practice and what does that look like and how can you work flexibly while still supporting each other. And I think what's been quite interesting in that one is how they have managed their funding. So initially when the We Rise Coalition decided to come together formally and resource formally their coalition work, they were initially aiming for a larger sum of money than they received. So once they received the final amount of funding, which is still substantial support, they did then have to have a process within the coalition to negotiate how they would share that funding out. And I think it's important to note this example because in contrast to the stereotype of CSOs competing for funding and undercutting each other for funding, there was a strong connection to this principle which enabled them, particularly the larger organisations, to cut right back and to take real costs and real blows to their funding in order to ensure that the smaller organisations within the coalition would still have enough money to function. And that process continued for 6 or 7 months whereby when certain project activities fell short, there were then further discussions about how to share the existing budget out or how to assist each other to raise further funds. So the We Rise Coalition also receives funding from the European Union, also receives other smaller pots of funding in different ways. Transparency, accountability, and co-responsibility is probably the most challenging area for civil society organisations in working together. Not that they're not accountable to donors. I think that's an area that has received a lot of work and a lot of support. But co-responsibility to each other, accountability to each other, and the ability to call each other out for poor practice is, of course, a very difficult area. And as Nolene, who is one of the leaders of Diva for Equality, noted, it's far easier to call out those who are politically far from you, but to do it in a healthy way with a close ally, to have really, really awkward conversations about partner exchanges or about workplace practice is a much more complicated process. The final two principles under which they work are quite linked. And you can see from this example that the coalition is a very reflective one. So they do a lot of the kind of theorizing and thinking that outsiders often bring to work in the Pacific for themselves, and that's the way they prefer to do it. So some of their thinking around sustainability has been a very explicit thought that change doesn't happen through supply-driven approaches. They have to be demand-driven. And sustainable change is about collective action and working together, because it's that deep transformational change that really has to challenge power, and that can't really be done without it being very much locally led and with an aim towards movement building. I'll only briefly mention self-care because I'm now running out of time, but just to say that the type of work that these organisations do, and in fact many of the organisations that were mentioned, the PLP, Mampu Support, is dangerous and difficult work, both literally, like for bodies, like assault, but also over time, the stress, the wear and tear. And you do find high staff turnover, burnout, etc. in these organisations. So they've made a distinct effort to address this. I'm actually going to, because I think the most interesting part of this coalition is its process, so that we can come to achievements and reach, etc. at another time or during questions. So I'm just going to skip ahead and talk about one of the examples of the ways that the We Rise Coalition has worked. And so the We Rise Coalition has worked on local, regional, and global advocacy. They've created some civil society mechanisms, such as PACCOM, which is a Pacific coordinating mechanism that has attempted to make a lot more transparent and inclusive a platform for engaging with regional intergovernmental organisations. They have a very extensive rural reach. So again, belying the stereotype of the capital-based organisations, 74% of the beneficiaries they work with are actually rural-based. And they've done a lot of work on establishing their models. They've also done a lot of work on extending this kind of movement building across the Pacific towards transformational change. And one of the important moments for them has been the Pacific Feminist Forum, where it wasn't like branded as a We Rise Coalition event, but they each took a role in convening or being part of the organising of this event. And it's been quite critical in a number of ways, but one of which was the evolution of certain leadership within women's movements in Fiji, for example. It was quite interesting to watch Andy Finau Tambakaldoro, who is a leader of a very relatively conservative indigenous Fijian women's organization, being part of a feminist circle and talking about how her perceptions and perspectives on the role of trans women in the women's movement in Fiji and the Pacific had shifted, and ended with her inviting a trans woman through kind of provincial connections to a very important provincial meeting as a woman, a meeting. So that was actually a radical shift. And this is an example, again, of how the We Rise Coalition isn't just this discrete four-year project that we're looking at, but that work with Andy Finau, who is influential in important spheres, had been built on work that had begun through the Fiji Women's Forum, a space that many of these We Rise Coalition members were also a part of, and had been an iterative and developing process that had resulted in this very large change. It's quite interesting. We can go into it later because I'm getting lots of flags from there, so we'll keep moving on. To talk about, so what have we learnt? The process of coalition building can be just as important as the immediate outcomes. So rather than a really single-minded determination towards the outcome, in this coalition we see a real focus on process, because for this coalition, this is how they envisage sustainable change can happen. We also see a deep engagement between organisations, not just between individual leaders. And what that has meant is that at times of change or other sort of stresses placed on the coalition, they're able to stay stable. For example, the Fiji Women's Rights Movement had changed leadership 3 times in the last, 2 years? But through the deep and multi-layered engagement between the organisations, they were able to survive the transition of key individuals. So in that way, the coalition itself is quite adaptive. We learnt that trust leads to greater flexibility by looking at this coalition, that processes around trust building are value for money, are effective because they lead to a flexibility and a stability within the coalition. Also backed up some of the PLP findings around the role that donors can play in this space of being facilitative, rather than directive. Because this emphasis, and we've been hearing it throughout these 2 days, is that locally found and locally led solutions, basically taking the lead from your partners that you're working with, is the most effective way, and there really isn't another way to do this work. There's a question, though. So does this inclusivity and diversity lead to more sustainable change in the long term? And I think the time frame is what's critical here, because you know something Michael Wilcox said yesterday morning really stuck with me, which is that development is this crazy idea that we can do history in a hurry. And it's true, you know. Somebody else on the panel here yesterday said that social change does not happen within a project cycle. And again, we know this. You know, the work of many of you in this room, whether you're working with faith-based organizations or other groups, this is a slow process. It does happen in fits and starts, yes, but it's over time. So we're not really going to see the impact of some of this work for decades. So the real trick is recognizing how we can support it effectively now to help ensure that it is heading towards sustainable, transformative change in the long term. And I think I should probably stop there. Thank you.